Sunday edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast, coming back with another 15 and 60 that we've been long overdue on, this time on the Eastern Conference post-All-Star, post-trade deadline, joined as often by Danny LaRue. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Really, really good. Kind of recovered now from all the trade deadline mania. Everyone said this was kind of a boring trade deadline. I actually kind of disagreed with that. I thought it was a pretty interesting one, and seemed like there were like 10 trades or something, right?
Yeah,
so it wasn't.
It got more exciting after noon. Like, I think that was part of what confused people, was that if every deal that was reported at noon was the end of it, but then you had the Lance deal, and I think there was at least one other one after that were both interesting.
Yeah. So let's get started here. Like we did on the West 15 and 60, we're going to kind of go through using the handy companion of 538's playoff odds and kind of go in order of the playoff odds, talk about these teams' playoff potential, and obviously plenty of our other normal little nuggets. And so since this is the East, we'll of course be starting with the Cleveland Cavaliers.
So the Cavaliers have an over 99%, pretty much 100% chance of making the playoffs. Their expected record is 60-22, and right now they are 39-14, 12-5 since the last time we did this. So they're still trucking along, even though they're not where they were, you know, this position of strength they were a couple weeks ago the last time we did.
Yeah, I think that the Cavs, having made these trades, I'm very interested to see how they're going to use Channing Frye, and in what lineups. You know, I talked a little bit after the trade deadline of, can he play with Kevin Love? That is a front court that is going to be lacking in athleticism, to be sure, rim protection. Although Frye actually, I think, is a little bit of an underrated defensive player, as long as he doesn't have to get out in space. The Magic actually defended reasonably well when he was out there, and he is forcing only 47% shooting at the rim when he's there to contest. Didn't contest a ton of shots, only 23% of shots at the rim when he was on the floor, but that's also when he was playing power forward. I think he'll be used, hopefully, for the Cavs mostly as a center, at least defensively. So I think that there's an argument that they'll be able to hold up defensively with him on the floor. But what lineups would you like to see? What combinations with the other big men would you like to see with him out there?
Well, it's hard, because when you think about the idea of him at center, then if he's playing center, the power forwards that the Cavs have are limited. Of course, LeBron at the four would be fun, but that's something we've wanted forever. In terms of a specific lineup, I want to see offensively whether Love and Frye is enough. Like, let's say you put spacing, so let's say Kyrie, JR, LeBron, Love, and Frye. Is that, like, as close to unstoppable as they can get? And, you know, is that good enough to offset the potential defensive ramifications?
I think it probably is.
I think so, too.
Especially because, maybe you could say the Raptors, but I don't see any great offenses in the East that are just going to torch them repeatedly, that are just offenses that are so hard to guard and pick and roll that Love and Frye wouldn't be able to do with them. Now, I would be surprised if they close with Frye and Love. I think we're going to see Tristan Thompson still. Another interesting question will be, you know, is Mozgov just going to be totally out of the rotation almost now, or is there still going to be a role for him to play?
Yeah, that's a big question with this. And of course, his free agency, it's something we talked about the deadline. I think you were the first person I heard make it, but is that his free agency has changed in tenor a lot now, because they don't, while he's still a useful player, even if he's kind of lower than what we saw last year when he was pretty great most of the time after he got traded, is that there's a less urgency to bring him back. So that could change the way they think about their rotations, because they don't have to keep him happy, because even though he's an unrestricted free agent, they don't have to see him in the same way.
Yeah, and Frye, again, I think we're going to have to watch very closely the effect that he has on this team, especially offensively. The Magic always had their highest offensive rating when Frye was on the court this year, and they had a 2.6 net rating overall with him on the floor, despite the fact that he played next to Vucevic a lot, and that was a tough defensive front court. And for a team that really was, I think has like a 1.9 net rating in the Magic, the effect that Frye had, despite the fact that he looks kind of stiff, you don't think he can defend anymore, his shooting really does make a difference in all of the on-off metrics when he's been healthy for many of the last years, other than last year when he was unhealthy. So I think that he can really kind of take this Cavs offense, which has disappointed a little bit so far this year, especially as Kyrie is trying to find his form. I think that he could take them to being back to kind of the nearly unstoppable level that they were after they picked up Shump and JR and Mozgov last year.
I was thinking just now about how Fry and Thompson fit with their point guards. And so if you assume it's mostly going to be Kyrie and Dellavedova, I think Dellavedova Thompson makes more sense. And then Kyrie Fry is kind of a broad split.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense to me. Delly has that lob chemistry with Thompson. And I think that if you're going to run a pick and pop with Fry and Delly, especially if it's a little bit later in the clock, you can switch that and feel just fine about it. Fry, back when you, 5 years ago, was okay posting up on switches. Now I think it's really remains to be seen whether he can actually punish those or not. So I do think Kyrie, you cannot switch a big onto him. He will just blow by the guy or make an easy layup mid-range jumper for him. So that's when I think that's a great point, that he is probably better off playing with Kyrie than he is with Dellavedova on the second unit.
You ready to move on to Toronto?
Yes, sir.
So Toronto, 35-18, 11-3. They were 10-2. They were 11-2, I believe, before the All Star break. But then they lost their first game back. So they have a right now 538 gives them a 3% chance of winning the title and a 9% chance of finishing with the best record in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, Toronto. I wanted to actually take this opportunity to talk a little bit about some of their young guys who are barely playing. Norman Powell, Fabian O'Gara, DeLon Wright, Bruno Caboclo, all those are guys you would think might have some modicum of impact on their future. And none of them have really played much. Powell has played 156 minutes, but with only a 3.1 PER and 30% true shooting. Bebe actually has had a couple of moments. He was actually closed, I think, a game against the Hawks earlier in the year, and he has an 18.5 PER, someone who maybe should get a little bit more of a look, but he's 23, so he's got a ways to go, kind of spacey. And then Anthony Bennett has hardly played at all. It's looking like his career is essentially going to be over after this year. And then DeLon Wright has only played 41 minutes, and Caboclo has only played 4. Of those guys, who do you think is the most likely to really be a rotation-level contributor for this team in the future? Or who will be a rotation-level contributor soonest?
Bebe, I think he makes sense. They also might have a need if Biombo ends up leaving, because he has a player option and he can do whatever he wants after that. The other guys, it's hard because you haven't seen enough of them, but also the kind of the theory of the Raptors is, that they don't really need Wright in the near term. They signed Corey Joseph, who has worked out very well for them, and he fills a lot of the roles that the two guards, Powell and DeLon Wright, were originally going to do. And Bruno, I mean, they're not playing him. The whole famous Fran Fraschilla 2 years away from being 2 years away. Like, if that's, I can't speak to that because I haven't seen him play very much, but if he's raw like that, then this is a team that has high expectations. So you want a different type of young guy than maybe where those guys are right now.
Yeah, although DeLon Wright, you thought would be that guy. It's just he was then supplanted as they were able to get Joseph. Wright is already 23. Go into these guys' D-League stats a little bit. Wright has been excellent when he's been down in the D-League, 63% true shooting, getting to the rim quite a bit, and overall he has a 20.9 PER, so that's been pretty solid. And then Noguera, actually about the same PER as he has had in the league, and probably taking a few more jumpers as he's trying to expand his game in the D-League than he would be for the regular team. That's why he hasn't been quite as efficient as you might expect. And then Powell, another guy who has had a relatively high usage, 28% when he's been down in the D-League, and has been pretty efficient on that, 56% true shooting, just turning the ball over a ton with that high usage, because that's not the kind of player that he's going to be in the NBA. And he really, even in his career at UCLA, as you know, was never a guy who had the ball in his hands a ton and was creating offense. But I think the Raptors are doing a good job of letting these guys kind of spread their wings in the D-League a little bit. Their D-League franchise is right there in Toronto, so they can kind of shuttle these guys back and forth. But yeah, I think I agree with you that Bebe is probably the one who can help them the soonest, because they have plenty of wing guys, and Biombo could leave, and then they'll kind of need an athletic kind of shot blocker type on the second unit. Biombo signed for the room exception, but has a second year player option that he will undoubtedly not exercise and get back onto the market with after he's been a part of this excellent Raptors season.
Yeah, and that's actually, the Raptors are in that kind of weird situation just in terms of where they're going to have needs, because a couple of their non-key players but contributors are free agents. So, if Scola leaves, if Biombo leaves, then they're going to need some of these guys to step up. But if they can retain retain Biyombo, which I think they'd love to do, then you don't really have a need for Bebe.
Yeah, the Raptors now projected by 538 at 54-28, rather comfortably into the second seed. The next highest projection, as we'll get to now, is the Boston Celtics, who are 32-24, projected record 48-34. And they have been on a nice run, though, over their last, since we last checked in on them.
Yeah, they really have. And the Celtics are impressive just because I think, I don't know, does it feel to you like this is less of a kind of what a mirage than last year was? Because like when I watch them, I see a team that's just, they're just beating teams through less smoke and mirrors, but just like having more talent.
Well, I don't know. I think that they've outperformed their point differential a little bit when on this last run that they've been on. I think that what has really helped the most has just been finally solidifying the rotation, getting David Lee completely out of it. One of their big bugaboos was that they really could not score and were horrible with Isaiah Thomas off the floor. And basically, since January 13th, as per John Schumann of NBA.com, they now have actually been much better with Thomas off the floor, 9.2 net rating. And that's basically around the time that Lee basically stopped playing. And they've been getting better shooting from Jarebko, Marcus Smart, Tyler Zeller. And just the whole thing with David Lee and Jarebko, right? Like, I think even in this kind of stunted iteration of Lee as he's gotten older and lost athleticism, from an offensive standpoint, you'd say David Lee is a much more skilled player than Jonas Jarebko. But simply the fact that Jarebko can just shoot the ball and then that he has the versatility really to switch a lot defensively at the four, he helps his team more than David Lee does, despite being a less skilled player.
And that also compounds with the fact that a lot of the wings and the smalls that the Celtics are playing with those lineups are guys that aren't great shooters. So if you can get that from other spots, then you are expecting something different from the Marcus Smarts and the Avery Bradleys and Evan Turners of the world, and that makes them better too.
Yeah, the lineup of Smart, Bradley, Evan Turner, Jarebko, and Olynyk is one that when you throw in, say, David Lee for Jarebko, or you're not playing Olynyk at center, then you don't have enough shooting with those guys. Like, Smart is not really that great of a shooter. Turner is shooting horribly on three-pointers this year. Bradley is okay, but he's got to have guys get him open. And I think Olynyk playing center, although he's now out for a couple of weeks with an injured shoulder, is something that really, really opens up the offense. And we've said this several times in the program that teams know how to deal with a shooting four now, but a shooting five is something that most teams cannot deal with a traditional center. And Olynyk really, against backup centers, he can hold his own plenty defensively, and he's going to cause big problems for them trying to guard him at the three-point line.
I still don't see them really as a threat for the top two teams, do you? Like in a seven-game series?
Let's see how the Raptors look when Damari Carroll comes back. I think that could kind of push them to another level. But I also think that someone like DeRozan, who is really, really dependent upon drawing kind of BS fouls, when you've got playoff scouting reports, when you get the chance to get used to a guy over an entire seven games and know that he's just going to pump fake, that he doesn't shoot an amazing percentage on mid-range jumpers. I like the number of guys that the Celtics have to throw at DeRozan as well, but with Crowder, Turner, Bradley, Smart, like they have four guys that they can throw at them. They've got pretty decent point guard defense as well. I mean, it will be an interesting to see where they're going to hide Thomas. I hope we do see that matchup in the 2-3, because that would be a very, very interesting matchup. But I wouldn't necessarily make the Raptors absolutely enormous favorites in that matchups.
And anything else on the Celtics, or do you want to go on to the kind of weird collection that we have right after them in the East?
Yeah, I mean, they clearly have emerged as the third best team. I don't see them getting caught because there's really nobody behind them now, other than maybe you could say Charlotte, and they just lost MKG, that is playing well at this point.
Right, and you know, Miami has, they have the next best projection. Their 538 has them at 46-36 with a 95% chance of making the playoffs, but their projections have been buoyed by the way that they played the last couple of games, which my instinct is that those games are non-reflective because of playing, of course, without two of their best players.
Yeah, Bosch, still no timetable for his return. You have to imagine he's going to miss significant time I do, and Wade being out, I have to be honest, I actually, other than the fact that it's just pushing guy, if they just had sort of like an average guy coming off the bench to replace Wade with, I actually think they would probably be better without Wade, to be honest. I think that Dragic is actually a better player than Wade offensively, that Dragic is much better running pick and roll than Wade. He can actually shoot the ball behind a screen if needed. He's not gumming up the spacing when other guys are trying to go to work. And Dragic, it's no coincidence, has had two really, really nice games. They ran the Wizards off the floor last night. They've been playing at a much faster pace. And we've talked before, too, about how in crunch time, Wade has the ball every single time and Dragic basically never touches it. I think that Dragic is a more efficient offensive player than Wade, better at finishing at the rim, probably about the same in terms of vision. He's starting to develop a little more chemistry now with Whiteside as well. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens when Wade actually comes back. But I do agree with your overall premise that it's not necessarily sustainable what the Heat have been doing with all the guys who have been out.
And getting this experience when they're about to head into such a big open offseason is important because they need to have an idea of where they want to go, because, you know, they're going to have basically Dragic and Bosch under contract and almost everything else is open. So if you want to take the idea of maybe going in more of a Dragic friendly direction, they can do that. Of course, they're personality issues and things like that, but it is nice to kind of have an idea of what that would look like before you decide to either bite or not bite the bullet on.
I had put together something on how a long-term injury exclusion for Bosch might work, but maybe we'll save that for next time when we get a little bit more clarity on what happens with him and what his health status is. But I do think it's interesting to note where they are with respect to the tax now, especially if potentially you're going to have someone like Bosch being out for an extended period. They've already got Tyler Johnson, who's kind of out for the season. So there is a bit of a roster crunch for them. And they basically have $218,000 of room below the tax threshold. This is per our buddy Albert Namad. And each new contract that they sign for the minimum will cost them $5,500 per day. So that means they have 39 days of minimum contracts that they can offer before the playoffs. So they only have 13 players under contract, and they, you know, with potentially two guys out and perpetually someone else always injured too, like they really could stand aside some more guys, but they're going to want to avoid the tax as well. So at least 17 of these remaining 56 days in the regular season, they have to stay at 13, or they're going to go into the tax and they'll be in the repeater tax, and then they won't get to reset that clock in the repeater tax. And there's no way they're going over the tax this year. So with all that being the case, how would you try to like distribute the 39 days of player contracts that they can still have?
Well, I think you would want to try to use somebody in the earlier time frame, just because they have so many guys that are hurt right now and uncertain in that way, you know, like with Bosch, until we get a more clear diagnosis of really what's going on with him. I would try to use one then and then take a little bit of a break unless
so the problem is, I mean, you're basically, you can sign guys to two 10-day contracts in a row, you know, that's 20 days. So what you're saying is sign someone to a 10-day and then just let them go. Cause you can't, if you sign someone to a 10-day, you can't cut anyone else. They're already guaranteed. So that salary is locked in. I mean, I think if it were me, I would probably just want to wait until, because you also have the problem is someone plays well with you for a 10-day and then you don't immediately re-sign them. You could go sign with somebody else. So I think it's actually better off to just wait, those 17 days initially, and then maybe sign a guy or at least one guy, start bringing guys on 10 days at that point, so that if you do find a gem that you really want to keep, then you're not in a position where you have to dump him because you're going to go into the tax otherwise.
Yeah, there's a fair point with that. I just think that the benefit of having an extra player who can actually be on the court on your roster in terms of your record might actually be, they could be more useful now. And for me, that trumps that possibility. I mean, anybody who you're getting a 10-day to is still open to everybody else. So it's like, are you so much better at finding people than everyone else is? And you can argue with Tyler Johnson that maybe Miami is. But I still think that in terms of the one-loss record and seeding, you want to, I think depth, you know, for this, like, let's say this next 10 days is probably a little bit more important.
The other thing that they might do, although there isn't as obvious of a candidate on their roster for this now, is a couple of years ago when the Bulls were sort of playing the same kind of dance, although theirs was even more ridiculous because they had to go down to 12 players after they traded away Luol Deng to get under the tax. And then league rules were that you couldn't sign, couldn't be at only 12 players for more than 2 weeks. So they would sign a guy to be at 13 just for a little while and then dump him again to get down to 12. Like, that they did manage to avoid the tax. What they did at the end of the year was, with like a week left in the regular season, they waived Eric Murphy, and then basically kind of calling in a favor, Utah claimed him. And so that Eric Murphy was making the minimum as a second round pick just came off the books entirely. So that might be kind of something that the Heat could try, either because they waive a guy that someone else might have some interest in to just claim, and then take that guy completely off of their books for the whole year, or and for luxury tax purposes, or they could just kind of, you know, call in a little tiny favor for some other team. I mean, it doesn't, to claim a guy off waivers with a week left in the season, it costs you like $10,000 or something. So that might be an approach that we see with them, but there isn't necessarily an obvious candidate on their roster for that. Josh Richardson is someone that they like, and they dipped into their exception to sign him for a little bit longer.
And he has two more non-guaranteed years, so you can think about the benefits of that, of just having him on that contract.
Yeah, and Udonis Haslem might be the other guy. There are still some teams with cap space, but that's a pretty big salary to claim. And, you know, I think they probably want to at least have him around for the playoffs, assuming they still make it.
And they're the optics of his history with the Heat. You know, like, he's a guy who's been on that team.
Yeah, I mean, they are all into this Heat life for things. So they've kind of dumped the rest of the flotsam.
Yeah, there are a couple teams that are projected at 44 and 38. I want to start with the Charlotte Hornets, who I think are arguably the more interesting team, especially considering they just added Courtney Lee. Hornets and the Pacers are both projected at 44 and 38, but the Hornets, given their more recent success, they have an 89% chance of making the playoffs, which is higher.
They're 10-6 over their last 16, 28-26. Actually, one of these few teams, again, that we said is playing well. Really a shame that MKG is out. They were killing it in the few games that he played. They're plus 15.2 per 100 possessions with him on the court. But this is still a team that somehow is ninth in defense. They're pretty much average offensively, but ninth in defense, with a roster that, with MKG barely having played, you'd be hard pressed to point to a single above average defensive player on this team.
And in some ways, it's more impressive than that, because they're one of the rare teams that their bench is doing really well defensively. And again, you could talk about how their starting lineup with Steve Clifford, we've said this for years, that it's really impressive that they've been able to do it. But the guy with the bench's best defensive rating on their team is Jeremy Lamb, who primarily plays with backup.
Yeah, and Lamb, subjectively, he will get beat backdoor sometimes. You know, he can definitely like look bad. He'll miss rotations. He's got some pretty decent talent, though. He had great length. That was one of the big selling points for him coming out of college. And he's really just morphed into, I think, more of an offensive player than perhaps people would have thought, and less of a defensive player. But nonetheless, the fact that they have managed to defend that well with him on the court, granted, there are a lot of other factors, that's noisy, but I think that he is someone, considering how good he's been offensively, who probably deserves to have some more time, maybe at the expense of Jeremy Lin playing the two, and just kind of see what happens. You know, those numbers, you can watch with your eyes, and, you know, coaches will see mistakes. And I think a lot of coaches kind of overvalue mistakes in terms of taking guys out of the game. But, you know, overall, the performance with him out there has been good. And maybe it's time to at least give him more of a chance and decide whether, all right, yeah, he does make some mistakes, but he does some other good things, or he doesn't kill us overall. And maybe that number will turn out to be an anomaly, but I think there's enough there from a statistical standpoint that you want to give him a little bit more run than he's been getting. And he is the best net rating on the team by far. I think he's like 4.2 per 100 in the positive.
And one other nugget with him, this was as of the All-Star break, but it's probably still pretty close to true. In terms of synergy, splits it into pick and roll, ball handler, point per possession. Of course, we've talked about the limitations sometimes with that. He is number two among guys with more than 100 possessions in that, behind Stephen Curry in points per possession as a pick and roll ball handler, which was shocking to me.
Yeah, and that's, obviously, Curry is much more of a threat distributing as well. This is only on plays where he's actually either shooting or turning the ball over.
Right.
But that's something that's encouraging. And his shooting stroke, he's looked really good on floaters, finishing at the rim this year. I think that is a trade that is looking pretty darn good, to only give up a second rounder to get him. And then a contract that pretty much any rotation player making $7 million a year, as he's going to be for the next 3 years after this one, that's actually a pretty good contract in this current environment. The last thing I wanted to say on them is I would like to see them try a lineup with Batum at the four. And if they had Walker, Lee, and Lamb at one through three, and then just one of their many big men, that could be a lineup that would really be nearly unstoppable offensively. And considering that there are not a ton of post-up fours in the East who scare you, at least on a, you know, a regular season game-to-game basis, that might be something that they could try that would really light teams up.
I love it. Who would you have as the five there, Zeller?
Yeah, probably Zeller. He's probably the best defensive player of their fives, I would say. I mean, you could even try Marvin Williams if you wanted to, and then you could do a lot of switching and have a ridiculous amount of shooting on the floor, too.
Yeah.
You know, that's probably more of a junk gimmick lineup if you're trying to come back or something. But they've got a lot more guys who can play on this team, especially with MKG being out and Al Jefferson being out. He finally came back. I didn't get a chance to see how he looked against the Bucks the other night. But he came back from his surgery. His integration will be something to watch, especially how they do defensively with him out there. But that's another one, actually. If they wanted to go to that lineup with Batum at the four and then have Jefferson at the five, his post-ups, that would be a great way to get a lot out of his post-ups, even if, you know, you're probably going to get lit up defensively with that lineup. It's just, it might be something to try.
Yeah, it would have been fun if they had been close to full strength to see what they would have done against the Cavs. I think that probably would have been the 1-4, but they'll still be a fun team to watch.
Atlanta, 31-26 now, projected for a 43-39 finish. They're actually projected to be under 500 for the rest of the year, presumably because they have a tough schedule. 84% chance of making the playoffs. But, you know, I think the Hornets, Heat, Hawks, maybe even Bulls, if the Bulls can get healthy again, are all kind of in that mix for those next few seeds after the Celtics. But the Hawks have had two really, really disappointing losses to the Wizards and the Bucks. After some really disappointing news over the All-Star break that Tiago Splitter is having hip surgery and he's going to miss the rest of the season and all the way through to the Olympics.
Yeah, and it's really disappointing for a lot of reasons. And one of them is that I think he was a nice little a support piece for both of their bigs and as a rebounder, as a defender. And they don't have a true natural replacement for him, which is common. I mean, most teams don't have a guy who can really step in and replace somebody as good as Splitter who already comes off the bench. And what I've been thinking about with them is, so you had that injury, is just they're in a really tough place because they decided to keep everything that they have. And of course, they've had these two dispiriting losses, and congratulations, their next game is against the Warriors. So they're going to kind of have this, but where they go from here, because they're a team with Al Horford and, you know, kind of a lot of other question marks, that this is probably their best year of the near term. And what do they want from this year? And why didn't they really go for it if they were going to keep everybody?
Yeah, that's a great point. Now, Splitter, I thought that was a move that we liked, just taking him into cap space. We thought that he could really help. Unfortunately, he's just really been nicked up the whole year. He had those calf injuries. Now he has this hip injury. Really has not helped. But he was there to shore up a weakness of protecting the rim and also their defensive rebounding. They got destroyed by the Bucks, who are not even a good rebounding team, to the tune of 18 offensive rebounds, especially some huge ones down the stretch in that double overtime loss that they had to them. And they also, the Bucks were really able to get inside, and the Hawks didn't have a ton of rim protection. Jabari Parker went nuts at the rim on them as well. He had a career high 28 points in that game. So, all right, I understand why they did that. And he was kind of available basically for free. But what they also could have done was, instead of trading a first round pick for Tim Hardaway, and admittedly, I think they also got 2 seconds for moving down from 15 to 19, trade that first round pick to try to get someone who could help this year. You know, they're going to need some more wing help. Kent Bazemore has come through admirably, but overall, they could still use more there, or maybe try to get a more impactful big in the last year of his contract with that first round pick that they maybe could have tried to re-sign again, something like that to really go for. I mean, they traded a first round pick and got zero help this year. And as we've noted, you know, they kind of got lucky with the ages of guys last year. You got Korver now is 34, Horford 30, going to be a free agent. Millsap, I think he's going to be turning 31 soon. I mean, no one could have expected even that he would be as good as he was this year. So this was the time to go for it. You won 60 games last year, and they kind of just rolled things over a little bit, hedged their bets. I understand letting Carroll go. That was a rough contract, and he's been injured, so it's not like he would have helped them that much this year. But I thought that trading those guys away and just getting nothing that helped them this year, or trading those assets away and getting nothing that helped them this year, is going to, in retrospect, not look that great.
Well, so Tim Hardaway, even the rosiest opinion of him was more of a project because he wasn't good last year. And so you kind of think, oh, well, you know, if he goes through Hawks University and things work out, that's going to take some time. He's not going to go through and then 30 days later, all of a sudden he's a rotation player on this team that has high hopes. And also, while I wasn't the biggest fan of that trade, you think about what Brooklyn got when they, or what Portland got. They got Mason Plumlee, who is substantially more productive from a lower pick than what the Hawks gave up for Tim Hardaway Jr. So, you know, you could have gone even for a younger contributor, for a young contributor that's a little bit closer. And yeah, it's concerning, and they're in a tough spot with Horford just in terms of what he wants. But at the same time, they're still a good basketball team. It's not like this team is, we're lamenting like the overspilled milk. They still have potential. It's just that they're not going to reach those kind of heights that I think we all hope for.
Yeah, I think, and this is really kind of what we all thought this team was going to be. And I mean, look at, like, for example, what if they had traded for Nick Batum? They probably could have put together the assets to get him. You know, what if you gave up like, Dennis Schroeder, who still hasn't been that good, your first rounder or something like that, and got Batum, and then you could have re-signed him as well. He's been awesome. He's pretty young still. A move like that, and to get him to replace Carroll, then maybe you're looking a lot better this year than they are now. The other component of this too is, you know, I think they understand that their team isn't that good, but apparently the asking prices for Teague and Horford at the deadline were still incredibly high. And with those guys being free agents, or I'm sorry, with Horford being a free agent and Teague just kind of taking a step back and not even being that good, that was unrealistic. And now either one of two things, they're going to be paying Horford a ton for a 5-year close to a max, maybe not quite there, but, you know, still a pretty big contract. Or they're going to lose him, one of the two. So they kind of tried to hedge their bets for this year and, you know, still stay flexible, which they've done an admirable job of in the past, back, to be honest, when Danny Ferry was the GM. We haven't seen much from Coach Bud yet, in that regard, but they now have sort of failed in getting assets for the future and failed in being good this year because they, you know, didn't really pick a direction, I guess, is what you would have to say.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. You want to move on to Indiana, a team that I think we're a little bit rosier on?
Yeah. The Pacers have been playing much better, especially now that they had a great comeback win in Oklahoma City on ESPN on Friday night. That was pretty excellent. And they are now 44-38, 84% chance of the playoffs per 538's odds.
Yeah, and it's funny because they're 7-8 since the last time we did this, but when you watch them play, you can see the signs that they're going to be good now. And I also, you know, like Miles Turner has looked good the last couple of weeks, that I'm a little bit more optimistic of where they're going kind of in more of a long-term sense as well.
Yeah, I think they'll finish ahead of the Hawks. They're 29-25, so they're basically in pretty close to a tie with them. They've got a few more games to play. The Hawks have a lot of games under their belt, so they at least don't have to play as often of late. But the key for them, I think, in their last six games, they went on a losing skid, and now they're 5-1, was that they are now playing Jan Mahinmi and Miles Turner together in the starting lineup, and that has been fantastic. They had not played, I don't think, a single minute before these last six games, and now they're 5-1. They played 114 minutes together, to the tune of a 12.8 net rating and allowing only 90.3 points per 100 possessions defensively with those two on the floor.
And there are a couple things there. One is that Turner is just better than the other bigs that they were playing there. You know, I think that Turner and Mahinmi is not a perfect fit in any way. It's just that it's a lot better than what they did. But also where it has its strength is defensively, because Turner, as we've talked about before, is a great shot blocker. Mahinmi is an underrated rim protector. And you're not sacrificing as much. I also don't think teams are exploiting kind of the weaknesses of Turner at the four defensively as much as they will, like, let's say, in a playoff series. But they're doing a good job.
Yeah, in the one game I think that they have lost in that period was against Charlotte, and Charlotte has a lot of shooting, and they were able to force Turner when he was playing the four to close out to the three-point line, which he's getting better at. He moves better than you would think he would, but his footwork on closeout still is not great. You can definitely blow by him when he overcommits to the closeout, but despite those limitations, I know this is true in college. I read this a few years back, and I'm not sure whether it's true in the NBA, but I think it is, that if you just play taller guys, you play better defensively, even though you think, all right, you know, they're not going to be able to get on out on shooters, blah, blah. And maybe a team like Golden State has the ability to really make that be true. But most teams don't quite have the shooting to really punish those sorts of alignments yet. And maybe they do down the end of the games and you're really locked in. But overall, units with more height, with more shot blocking, with two bigs, defend a little bit better. And that's what we're seeing with these two guys on the floor together. They're doing a great job of that.
And that's what, you know, like with nylon calculus and everything, when they're doing rim protection, a lot of what the value of that is deterring people from taking the most effective shots in the game, which are shots that are really close to the basket. And so, yeah, you're giving up, maybe you're giving, possibly you're giving up more deep shots, but if you can take away the rim, especially with the way some teams are constructed, you're taking away one of the lifelines of their offense. And so the kind of the spillover effects from that can be better, even though you're sacrificing.
Yeah, and maybe Turner or Mahimi are going to overcommit and run past a guy at the three-point line, and he can drive in. But then you have the other one waiting there still, you know. So that's it's definitely helpful. And then Turner's shooting is good enough. We hope he finally made his first career three-pointer, I think, against Oklahoma City on Friday. We'll probably see more of that from him now with him playing the four offensively. But his shooting is hopefully good enough that those two guys can get by playing together on offense as well.
Yeah, I think they definitely have potential with it. But I think it's funny, I kind of started with this, but it's like part of what made the Pacers situation so frustrating early in the year was that they were kind of reacting to this spot of where their talent was by playing people like Jordan Hill, who just isn't as good as these players. And so we had talked about how it's like, well, who else are they going to play with the whole CJ Miles at the four thing? And the answer was Miles Turner.
The Bulls, 28-26. They had a desultory loss in Cleveland, with Mirotić and Butler still out. Those are obviously key pieces, and Noah as well, obviously, has been out for forever. But they are now projected to be 42-40, 67% chance of making the playoffs after that rousing win against the Raptors, whom they are now 3-0 against. All those games were like crazy games. Tony Snell had 16 in the fourth in the first one of those games. Jimmy Butler, 40 in the second half, was the next one. And then Doug McDermott, 30 points, career high in this most recent game on Friday, was also pretty ridiculous. But I think this team is still going to struggle until their guys come back, though. And there is one nice thing, though, to see is that Derrick Rose is finally starting to play a little bit better.
Yeah, and you could, that's something that you can see both in the stats and from the eye test. He has more consistent explosion than he did, let's say, a year ago, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't even know. Is versus a year ago. I thought he had some moments when he was healthy last year as well, but certainly compared to early in the year, I think that the fact that he was on the court initially after just breaking his face so badly that, you know, he's not a guy who is a quick healer. And despite his comments constantly about how confident he is and how hard he works, I think he is a guy who struggles with confidence and with his injuries. And now he's finally starting to get back to there. Earlier in the year, he was shooting something miserable, like 40% in the restricted area. Now in the last 15 games, he has taken 78 shots in the restricted area, shooting 56% on those. And then in the paint, non-restricted area, shooting a respectable 43%, also 40% from mid-range, which is much better than he was doing last year. He's found now, I think one of the big reasons that in that national TV interview in the Bulls game, Luke Walton said, hey, we want to send Rose right, is because Rose has really found a comfort zone going to his left and then pulling up off the glass from the left side of the floor. And so that comprises a lot of these mid-range shots now that he's shooting outside the paint. And he's hitting finally a respectable percentage on those again. And, you know, especially if he's on the left side of the floor, if he gets iced, he can pull up for that shot and be pretty effective with it.
And you look at what he's doing in recent stretches you were talking about, and it's nice in terms of percentages, but also in composition, that he's getting to the rim more, and that, you know, if your mid-range restricted area is pretty close for him, I mean, of course you'd like to tilt it a little bit more towards the rim just because those are better shots, but I think you can live with that where it is. If he could either take less above the break threes or make more of them, that would be helpful, but, you know, you can't get everything.
The Bulls still are in the bottom quartile of the league in offensive rating, despite playing a little bit better than they did very early on in the year. And despite the fact that Nikola Mirotić was supposedly having such a down year, and he was to a certain extent, he still has one of the best net ratings on the team among the guys who actually plays regularly. And they have a respectable offensive performance with him on the floor as well. And he's another one of these guys that like Channing Frye, even if he's not shooting an unbelievable percentage from three, he does, he shoots well enough that you still have to guard him out there. He has enough of a reputation that he gets guarded out there. And the Bulls offense, I think, has really, really missed him. I mean, the problem long term, of course, is if they re-sign Pau Gasol, he and Mirotić can't really play together defensively. And the other guy I would talk about a little bit too is Tony Snell. The Bulls have defended extremely well with him on the court, allowing only 95.3 defensive rating. Pretty bad offensively too, because he doesn't do anything other than just hit wide open threes, and he shoots a terrible percentage on twos. But he is a guy that I'm like not ready to give up on yet. I think he can defend reasonably well, especially if he's not in a power matchup, and you know, he can shoot open threes, and that is enough to really make a decent player. And I think that despite the fact that he doesn't do all that well from the traditional box score stats, the team plays well when he's out there.
When you said one more guy, I assumed you were going to go with McDermott, who's looked better to me recently as well.
Yeah, he's had some off and on times, but yeah, that performance against the Raptors was fantastic. He was 4 of 5 on threes, 13 of 17 for 30 points in 31 minutes in that game. And one thing I've praised on the show repeatedly is just his ability to move without the ball. He got some great cuts in that game, and his shooting ability has sped up his release now, has really set that up. When they get some good ball movement and guys like Gasol can find him from the high post, and he just always cuts hard. He always moves the ball if he doesn't have a shot right away. I really still think that he could be a very, very good offensive player. One thing that we have not seen from him at all that I'd like to see is a lot of times teams are hiding, you know, their point guard on him or a smaller shooting guard. I'd like to see him get into the post against those guys a little bit, because I think he actually can score pretty well there. They just haven't given him the chance to. But the biggest thing for him offensively is just he kind of flips these shots up around the rim, and he just has to get a little bit more comfortable with dealing with NBA shot blockers. He'll flip it up so fast that he's able to get the shot off, but he's just kind of missing it. And he finally was starting to hit those shots in this game, and that's how he was able to be so incredibly efficient. And we'll just not talk about his defense for now.
What I wanted to say kind of that tangentially relates to that is that I think part of the reason his on-off looks as shaky as it does is that there were these lineups they were playing early in the year when they were playing Mirotić, Gasol, and McDermott together, and that just shouldn't have happened. And so you think things like that, which I've talked about before with the Wolves, kind of poison the well for thinking about some of these things just because it's a non-representative thing that shouldn't happen, but if it's bad enough that it'll look bad for a long time.
Yeah, still though, if Butler doesn't come back soon, this team is going to be in trouble. They still are in very grave danger of missing the playoffs. I think that 67% chance of making it overstates, and I think they'd be very lucky to go 500 while Butler is out. I think that they have really no chance of stopping anybody without him. I mean, even when, and Gibson is really the only guy on this team now you really look at as being a very good defensive player. We'll see if Justin Holiday can get into the mix at all there. I don't necessarily suspect that that's going to happen. I don't think he's a better player than Snell, McDermott, or Dunleavy, frankly. So we'll see, though. I'm sure he'll get a little bit of a chance. They traded for him for presumably some kind of reason. Let's get to Detroit. I think Detroit is listed at having lower odds than the Bulls, 37% projected record of 40 and 42. But I think with the trades that they've made, yeah, backup point guard is concerning, but this is also a team that has a ton of depth now.
They have a ton of depth, and they can play them in a lot of different combinations. You know, this is a team that I referred to it when I talked to Seth about the kind of the amorphous blob that is their front court rotation. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that in a positive, that you have players with a lot of different strengths and weaknesses. And of course, you have a guy in Drummond who can be a positive force in that he's a very good player. So I'm intrigued to see not only how it works, but just to see what combinations they try there, especially when Kentavious Caldwell-Pope is healthy, because they don't really have another two that can do what KCP can.
Yeah, I mean, I still expect him to get a ton of minutes as their only guy really who's a good defender of ones or twos, because Reggie Jackson most of the time is going to get hidden on whoever the worst wing threat is, and KCP will guard the point guard if the point guard's good. But I mean, you look at some of the names that they have now, Reggie and KCP, obviously, I think those guys are going to keep starting. But then you've also got Meeks and Thornton as somewhat redundant pieces off the bench. It'll be interesting to see. Meeks is now getting back to full practice, so he should be coming back soon. Thornton, you know, I think of Thornton is sort of like a more incandescent guy who can go off, but Meeks is maybe a more consistent shooter. neither of them are any great shakes defensively. So it'll be interesting to see who kind of takes the lead for minutes among those two guys at the backup too. Then Demo still was meeting with a back specialist this week in New York. So that doesn't sound like he's going to be ready to go back and play. But I guess the fact that the trade went through is at least some indication that he is nearing health. Otherwise, you know, you can't imagine that he would have passed his physical. And then you've got Tobias Harris, you got Marcus Morris. And what is your starting line? And you still got Anthony Tolliver too, as another guy who could be in the rotation. Aaron Baines, who I don't think is that good, but they gave a $5 million a year contract to Steve Blake. You know, they need someone to play backup point guard, you would think. So all those guys really, for a team that had no depth at the start of the year, now they really have a ton except at backup point guard. What would be your starting lineup? What would be your top eight? Who would be out of the rotation?
Okay, so my instinct is I would start, of course, Drummond, KCP, and Reggie. Those are the easy ones. Then I would probably start Tobias Harris, and I would start Marcus Morris, and then have a quick pull if either one of them isn't doing very well, maybe for Demo, and then you get him a little bit in the groove, and then he subs for Drummond. I like the idea. I've talked about this before of bad free throw shooters. I think they should play the first stretch of every quarter, so that would work with Drummond. So then you have the ideas that Monty Yunus and or Baines, when Monty Yunus isn't healthy, plays center for, let's say, the last 4 minutes of every quarter, except for the fourth where you switch around just because you want Drummond out there. And so you kind of work with that. And I like the idea of Tobias Harris playing with the second unit. So that might be the guy you give the quick hook to. Well, kind of like what I like with Porzingis with the Knicks right now. So you would bring in Demo for Harris. So then you bring Morris back to the three, which is where he's played a lot of the year. Then eventually you pull Drummond, and then you slide, you know, you figure it out from there. And then that's also kind of what maybe when you bring Tobias Harris in for Marcus Morris. So I think that's kind of the core of it. And then, of course, KCP, you play him a lot and you work with that. So in terms of an eight, I like Stanley Johnson. I think that also intuitively he's probably the best 3-4 defender they have. So if there's a situation where you need somebody like that, then you kind of front load his minutes. I've talked about this before, that like it was always my theory with Rondé, was that you need to play him with the starters sometimes because there isn't much use for a perimeter stopper against backup.
My prediction is that Stanley is going to be relatively out of the rotation, and while he's had some flashes this year, he just hasn't shot the ball well enough to be efficient, and he's had a relatively high usage for a guy who has been really inefficient. I think so. It's quite possible. I think that Thornton and Meeks play more than he does, at least for this year. I totally agree with you that having Harris and hopefully Demo as well can solve their second unit offense problems. I would have Baines out of the rotation unless Demo gets into foul trouble or something. I mean, obviously it's going to take Demo a while to work back into really being able to play more than 15 minutes a game or so, you would have to imagine. And then, I mean, I guess it's going to be Steve Blake at backup point guard, but maybe you could say, you know, we'll just play Meeks or Thornton out there instead at backup point guard, and then we just have enough guys in Harris and Demo who can kind of post up ISO. We'll get our points that way instead of just trying to run pick and roll, which Steve Blake can't do anyway. You know, Blake is pretty much relegated to being a spot up shooter, and he turns the ball over a fair amount anyway, even for a guy who's supposed to be sort of a caretaker type. So I would try to minimize his minutes. I might try and see if you could get by without a point guard, but although that always seems like a great idea, those lineups rarely actually seem to work in practice, but I might at least give it a shot there.
Yeah, I consider giving it a shot. Anything else with them, or you want to move on?
Yeah, who's next?
The Washington Wizards, the team that I continue to believe will somehow make a run to the playoffs. They are 25-29, 7-10 since the last time we did this, and they're projected 27% chance of making the playoffs, 39-43 estimated record.
Yeah, that's a little bit better. They went through this three nights stretch, and really something that I think hurt them, because they had a game that you would have hoped they could have won last night in Miami, and they just got run off the floor. They looked really tired, gave up a buck 14 to a Miami team that was really, really shorthanded. And you have to wonder if they hadn't been tired, that they could have put in a better effort there. They have also been back to starting Nene and Marcin Gortat. They went away from that with much fanfare in the playoffs last year with Paul Pierce at the four. Then this year as well, they're playing at a crazy fast pace. And, you know, then Nene missed a lot of time too. But hey, guess what? They actually had been stopping teams. They had a great defensive effort against Utah on Thursday with both those guys starting. And then they beat the Hawks as well. I think they started Nene in that game as well. And then they rested Nene more last night, didn't start him And guess what? The defense, you know, went to pot again. So I think another one of these teams that they just, yeah, playing small is great. I totally advocate playing small when all other things are equal, but Nene is just a better player than some of these wing guys that they've been trotting out there.
And the hope is that once he gets settled, that Markieff Morris can, you know, help a lot of that. And I think he can, especially if he can have his head on, you know, as close to straight as it can be right now. And what I like about the Wizards, and I'm not as big a fan of, you know, giving up a first round pick in the way, especially with the protection they put on it, but they have a deeper rotation now, which is incredibly important because, you know, allows guys like Otto Porter and Jared Dudley to maybe get into a role that is a little bit better for them, at least for the rest of this season.
Yeah, I don't know. I think offensively, both those guys aren't shooting very often. You know, Dudley has a great true shooting percentage, like 62%, but also a tiny usage rate. His usage rate is like 12% or something, which is about as low as you're ever going to see for a wing player. You know, he's basically just shooting standstill threes at this point, and that's what he should be shooting. That's all he's good at. And then Otto Porter, he increases usage a little bit from last year. He shoots a really nice percentage at the rim in the high 60s. But the problem that he has still is he probably takes too many long 2-point jumpers. And then he also doesn't shoot all that well from 3-point range. He only shoots 33%. And for a guy who's not taking that many shots, you got to get that up 35, 36, you know, and he's not, despite his length, he's not really that great of a defensive stopper one-on-one either. So I still think that he is a very much a lower end starter at this point. Still relatively young, only this is age 22 season, but you know, I think that the fact that he's had to play such a large role this year is perhaps an underrated factor in why they haven't been as good as maybe people would have thought.
That's definitely fair.
All right, who we got next?
The Orlando Magic. They are 24-29, 4-11 since the last time we did this. And they're still kind of with the way that they've been playing. They still have a slight chance. Their projected record is 37-45, which 538 gives them a 12% chance of making the playoffs.
Yeah, they are the first game that they had with those guys from the Bucks. I think they beat the Mavericks, right? So that's a
right
win that you wouldn't have necessarily have expected them to get at home. So that helped their odds a little bit. Brandon Jennings already closed the game for Elfrid Payton. And one thing that's been talked about a little bit, but we should probably get into a bit more, is the way that these trades have gone down and even the Skiles hiring. You remember I had Eddie Rivera on back in the fall for the Magic preview, and he said, you know, basically that hiring Skiles was sort of the brainchild of Alex Martins. Alex Martins, not really a basketball guy. I mean, I'm not a basketball guy either. I'm a lawyer. You know, I just played in high school, but so I don't want to preclude anyone's ability to learn. But he started off in the PR department. He's always kind of been more on the business side. But is the president. He also had some sort of odd little developments in the Dwight Howard saga. But Skiles was an Alex Martins hire. And now, unsurprisingly, Scott Skiles has Alex Martins' ear. And he outranks Rob Hennigan. And so it is not a huge surprise. I mean, I'm not privy to inside information with the organization. But reading the tea leaves, it's not that hard to figure out, hey, guess what? Scott Skiles wanted to get rid of Tobias Harris, which he had already done in Milwaukee, for nothing. He basically did that again. And they got two guys who had played under Skiles before, Ilyasova and Jennings, that he has more trust in. And then Jennings, of course, is playing over Payton. So the fact that Skiles would be hired by Martins and that now Skiles has Martins' ear and Skiles is getting what he wants shouldn't be surprising anyone at all.
It shouldn't. And there's a parallel. Of course, he doesn't have the personnel power that, let's say, Stan Van Gundy has, but that those teams that have coaches with a high voice in the personnel process are more willing to give away a talented player for nothing. Like the Josh Smith non-deal and just outright just cutting him is another example of that. And I think that's something that a coach is more willing to do. It makes a different kind of statement than a GM who has to look more at the long term and would maybe be more open to pursuing something that maximizes that possibility.
Yeah, and ultimately, I think ultimately those are things that can kind of add up in your organization. And, you know, we'll see. I think that one aspect of having the coach be the GM or at least have some more say in personnel is that at least when you get someone, they're going to get used. Although that certainly isn't what happened in Atlanta with Tim Hardaway, but generally that happened. So, you know, and I think that they're Jennings with his shooting certainly should close some of the time about instead of Payton because Payton doesn't get guarded, especially when you get down in crunch time and teams really lock in defensively and on the scouting report, and you have your coach reminding you of what to do in the huddle every time. So we'll see. It'll be interesting to see how much Ilyasova is going to play, how much Jennings is going to play, how much that affects sort of these young core guys, you know, more the guys that you would think of as kind of Rob Hennigan guys instead of Skiles guys, and that, you know, were really invested in by the organization before Skiles arrived.
One other thing I wanted to talk about with you, I went on Sam Vecenie's show and talked a little bit about this. We just were kind of spitballing, and my theory with Orlando was kind of the idea that I think a lot of the max free agents in this class, because of course one of the big things they did the deadline was they cleared space. And my personal feeling is that a lot of the max guys in this class, excluding the restricted free agents, who a lot of them make sense, don't particularly fit with where Orlando should be going just in terms of when they'll peak and everything like that. Do you agree with me, or do you think there's some guys that make some sense?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because you still have so many young guys on this team and Vucevic as well. I think the number one thing that they need isn't necessarily a max. I mean, I think actually Joakim Noah would be a very nice fit with them. You know, presumably they're going to re-sign Fournier as well, but someone who can pass the ball a little bit, but also just play real good pick and roll defense, protect the rim, you know, instead of Vucevic, but Vucevic is someone they have a big investment in too. I mean, the max guys, I agree with you, someone like Horford is 30, 31, but you also can't have all young guys, and this is now their third year in the wilderness after trading Dwight Howard. I'm sure there is plenty of organizational pressure to get better. There always is after that amount of time on a rebuilding project. The Skiles hire reeked of impatience. Skiles himself is rather impatient. So I think that they are just going to try and get the best player available no matter what his age and figure it out. And you have enough young guys on the team that maybe, you know, at some point worrying about the whole timeline thing doesn't make a ton of sense, and you need some vet who's going to teach these guys how to win and all that. But I do agree. I mean, there's, if you're going to get another kind of restricted free agent, maybe they want to dip their toes in that water, but you don't want to wait around for those guys until the end of the moratorium, and then you don't get them either. You get matched, and then you're getting nothing out of your $50 million in cap space. So I do expect them to push very hard for the best free agents on the market and offer them the opportunity to play together.
And they are hurt by the complete lack of point guards in this class. I think that is the clearest need for them. Elfrid Payton's not a bad player, but I think that he would be much better served if you had another guy who was orchestrating the offense with the starters, and then you could, at least for now and while he figures it out. But there aren't those guys. You know, I don't think they should be signing Mike Conley. I don't think he makes sense with their timeline. And that's a challenge for them. But there isn't really, that's just one of the limitations of the system. You know, that's just who's available right now, and there's nothing that can really be done about that. Oh, but where I was going with that was that I'm wondering if they're going to overpay Brandon Jennings.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you could see, and Ilyasova, they can keep him. What is his guarantee date, actually? Probably actually something that's going to be important.
I don't know offhand.
That's something we should probably look up and tell the listeners before we go, because that's going to be important. If they, I mean, he's on under what you might say is a good contract, but you're probably not getting to max cap space unless you, you know, waive him. And so can you figure out whether you're going to get the guys that you want, in free agency, those two max slots getting up to almost $50 million? Or are you going to just, I mean, if they can't get that, then it probably behooves them to just hold on to him, especially because it's kind of a shooting challenge team anyway.
According to Eric Pincus of Basketball Insiders, it guarantees on July 1st. So congratulations, you have a tough decision.
Yeah, that is going to be very, very interesting. You know, I guess they'll have one day to try and get guys under contract, but typically the best free agents take their time, as is their right, and they'll do all these visits and stuff like that. So, yeah,
but if they waived him once he was guaranteed, don't you think somebody would claim him?
That's another very interesting question.
I've been thinking about that with the Celtics, that, you know,
or they could always just trade him to,
yeah,
you know, if they needed to.
You know, let's say the Pacers, like if the Pacers strike out in free agents and you say, hey, we need to clear the space to sign Joakim Noah, then we could, you know, would you want him? And they said yes.
Yeah, that's going to be a very interesting dance, though. I mean, I think you're right, probably, that they will just end up guaranteeing it and then figure that they can get off of that salary if they really need to, that they can make a trade.
Yeah.
Or even if they absolutely had to, they could just stretch him, you know, and then they could still probably get to where they needed to be, sure, to bring in the two max free agents. All right, that's enough on them. Who's next?
Next, the Milwaukee Bucks. The Milwaukee Bucks are 23-33, 7-8, including a rousing win, double overtime win last night. And their playoff projections are actually rosier than I would have them, and that I would probably put it myself, which is 6% chance of making the playoffs, 36-46, which would actually be them going .500 the rest of the way.
Huh, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, they haven't struck me as like playing incredibly well. I guess they are 7-8 since we last checked in on them, so that's better than they have been playing. Jabari Parker offensively, he had 23 against Charlotte, 28 against Atlanta, has looked real good at times. He is getting a great knack now for cutting along the baseline, which is something that the Bucks desperately need. Or even when he's out on the wing, if somebody drives in, he'll sort of cut in from the 45 degree angle behind that guy and kind of catch like a lead back pass, and then he can take off and finish. He's just getting a ton of dunks lately and really is getting to the point where he looks about as athletic as he did. The last thing that we really hadn't seen from him was that beautiful step back jumper, which he can get in isolation against anyone. And we saw against Charlotte, when guys like Kaminsky or something were trying to guard him, that Jabari was able to just get wide open jumpers from 15 feet in isolation. I still think that his ability as an isolation scorer is something that ultimately is going to be very, very important for this team to tap into, and also a reason why I ultimately would kind of like to see them with a little bit more of kind of a shooting point guard. But they're making it work with the guys that they have at this point, and even maybe more of a shooting big man than Greg Monroe, but he's only under contract for another year, so you wouldn't imagine that. Maybe he will, but I would say the odds of him sticking around in Milwaukee after those 2 years, considering the fit issues with Giannis and Jabari, may not be that high. And he's also thrown some great passes in these last couple of games as well. I think he actually has a very nice passing vision going back to his days at Simeon. The only problem with him, though, is that he does absolutely nothing else other than score and throw an occasional pass.
Yeah, so there are kind of two different things with him that I wanted to kind of go through. One is you focused more intuitively with him on the positive, which is great. He's a great scorer and all that. For whatever reason, I see what he can't do more than what he can. But I think yesterday was a good example of what he can. And while Giannis fouling out made this more possible, at the end of regulation, Jason Kidd ended up going with a Jabari Parker isolation to do it, and Parker made the shot. He just took probably about two beats too long with Millsap on him to really take the shot, and so it didn't count.
Yeah, Jabari, his rebounding is horrendous. He just does not have a great rebounding instinct. A lot of times when he's defending, he just does not get his nose back in there. And this is a Bucks team that is one of the worst defensive rebounding teams in the league. Jabari has a 12.5% defensive rebounding percentage. That's worse than Michael Carter Williams. He doesn't get any steals. He doesn't get any blocks. Doesn't really get to the foul line all that much either. These days, I think that's something if you put the ball in his hands a little bit more, it might happen more, but he's a guy that, despite his big body, most of his moves are finesse moves at this point, and he's really good at those. Don't get me wrong. He has great athleticism, but I'd like to see him kind of bully guys, go through guys a little bit more. But when he's being guarded by power forwards, it kind of makes sense that he's more focusing on the finesse stuff. But anyway, yeah, I mean, and he's also awesome in transition. That's another thing, that he really runs the floor hard, beats his guy down floor, especially if he's being guarded by a big. So I think although I'd still like to see more from him in the non-scoring categories, I think he is, considering the major injury that he had, I think he has been about as good as you would have hoped so far this year.
Do you think that those kind of the zeros across the board and the other stuff, how realistic do you think it is that he could improve at least a couple of those to getting, let's say, to passable, not to necessarily making them a strength?
Yeah, I do wonder about that. I mean, steals, blocks, not the kind of thing that you generally are that good at improving. Rebounding, it's kind of more of an instinct thing, not something that you see guys improve a ton of. I do think he can get much better with assists. I think that's one thing that
and drawing
really
fouls
improve on and drawing fouls. So that I think can help. But yeah, the sort of non-ball in his hands categories, it is a little bit disappointing. And I think he's always going to have a little bit of a ceiling as a player just because of his inability to contribute in those other areas. And he's also terrible protecting the rim as well.
Yes.
So we can get that out of the way.
Yeah. So what I think about with him is just what you want as a complement and a center, and you're asking a lot. But, if you can get the right guy, then but Jabari, we've talked about before, getting reliable offense is a very valuable skill.
Yeah. And they have other guys on this team who have length and can defend. It's really a shame for them, number one, I mean, I still think that Brandon Knight, while he has his limitations and has also not really been healthy since he's been traded away, his shooting, I think, would have been a pretty good fit offensively. And then someone like Larry Sanders, who obviously, you know, didn't have the desire to play any longer, I think what he could have given them defensively would have been a really nice fit next to Giannis and next to Jabari. Who's next?
The New York Knickerbockers. They are 24-33, a less than rousing 4-12 since the last time we did this. Their current estimate, so they were, for a long time, they've been considered kind of the last of these teams that has an outside shot at the playoffs. They maybe still do. I don't think they do. But so their projected record, 33-49, and a less than 1% chance of making the postseason.
Yeah, and that seems about right to me. Just because this team just doesn't have that good of players. You know, Kristaps and Carmelo. I mean, this is one nice thing to say is, hey, you know, at least we play well with our stars on the floor. You know, those are the only guys with positive net ratings on the team. And then Lopez, I think, is next best at -0.5. And those are the three good players that they have on this team, right? Like, when you take those guys off the floor, you're not going to do as well. I did want to talk a little bit about Carmelo. There was some talk of moving him at the deadline, but he does have the no trade. Some articles have come out recently, like Frank Isola talked about how these guys are kind of stuck in a marriage together that's not really working for either of them. This will be their third straight year out of the playoffs. And Carmelo, I think, has looked about as good as I could have thought coming out off of a major knee surgery, being 31. But his best days now are clearly behind him, despite the fact that I think he's trying as hard as he ever has. He's has a career high in rebound rate and a career high in assist rate. But his usage is down from his best seasons in 2013 and 2014. You know, he's down to 29% usage now. He used to be in the 30s. True shooting percentage is down. His percentage of shots at the rim is now down to about the low 20s. And his shooting is also really declining. He's shooting 54% at the rim, which is absolutely terrible, even though he's never been a great finisher at the rim. Then he's also only at 33% on threes. And in his two best years in New York, he was in the high 30s in 1 year, shooting 40%. So if he's going to be really efficient in the future, if you're not getting to the rim a lot and you're not shooting a great percentage when you're there, you got to shoot, you know, above league average on threes to really be efficient. He does get to the foul line a fair amount too, obviously, still. But he's got to get that 3-point percentage up. And considering all the lower body issues that he's had, he shoots a jump shot from three. So he really needs his legs. And ultimately, I think you have to conclude that he's not good enough to be the primary scorer on a good team anymore the way he was in the 2 years before his injury.
Yeah, I have no argument with any of that. And what I'm intrigued by with him and the Knicks and their marriage, as I so put it and as you put it, is not as much people have talked about, you know, what you would get back for him. And I think, you know, that's kind of ancillary. The question is, can you find a team that he wants to go to and that really wants him? Because even just getting the salary to match, unless you're trading him into space during the offseason, which I think is the most likely way that you're going to move him. If you can get that part of it, then I think they'll probably have something happen. But that's complicated because it seems like he loves living in New York. The other team in New York is basically just as hopeless, probably more hopeless, actually definitely more hopeless than they are. And so everything else for his family is a big move, for his lifestyle. So we can talk about it, but I think in the most likely thing in the near term is that he'll do what he wants best, and that's to stay in New York.
Yeah, he's been linked to the Bulls, but I don't think he's a good fit for the Bulls anymore with what Jimmy Butler has emerged into. Jimmy Butler is kind of has very similar game to him at this point with the kind of ISO ball, and Butler is more efficient, a better player than he is. You know, maybe you could say we're going to play Carmelo at the four and just kind of go all offense, but that team is never going to stop anybody, especially with them not having any good defensive big men locked under contract for a while, or at least good centers. So yeah, I mean, that'll be a whole nother episode when we do their offseason preview of, hey, where would it make sense for him to go that he would actually want to go? You know, it's interesting. I mean, maybe, you know, it would be actually hilarious, and I don't think they would do this, but like, what if they just waived him?
There'd
be a ton of teams this summer that would just have the space to just pick him up if they wanted to, and you just say, you know, just to get him off the books. But
the most dangerous game of all.
Yeah,
just an outright waiver of Carmelo Anthony.
Yeah, that's totally unrealistic. That's actually, I'm sounding like you now with these like ridiculous scenarios.
That's not even something I would have said publicly.
Yeah.
I had thought of it before though, to be honest.
I'm recording at like 9,000 feet altitude here. I think like the lack of oxygen might be getting to me.
I'm thrilled.
Can we move on before I say something else stupid?
Of course we can. But so the next team is the team that the Knicks actually lost to, and I only watched a little bit of it, but one of the more depressing games that I have watched all season, and that is the Brooklyn Nets. And the Brooklyn Nets are pretty much what we thought they were. They're 15-40, 4-12 since the last time we did this. They are projected to be 22-60, and the big question with them is, even though they don't have their own pick, where do they fit in among the worst records? Because that matters for the league, even if it doesn't matter for them.
Yeah, I mean, and Nets fans probably don't need us to harp on that too badly. But yeah, I think that their duel with the Suns to see who's going to be lower is something that a lot of people will certainly be following. A couple of little news items here, or actually only one. Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, the talk was he'd be back in February, but they obviously have little incentive to force him to come back. He's been doing some light practicing, but he's not going to be reevaluated still for another 2 weeks. So if he comes back at the end of the season, it's not going to be for very long, but hopefully he'll be able to kind of, with them completely out of it now, they will have a chance to see if he can expand his game a little bit offensively and really cement himself as a starter going into next year. Another guy who, in looking at the stats, really surprised me was Thomas Robinson. He was one of these minimum guys that they signed that really, on the surface, has been terrible. You know, he's shooting a pretty miserable percentage, but he does shoot 63% around the rim, which is much better than he's done in past years. That was always his big problem going back to his Sacramento days. And defensively, he actually has a 4.7% two-point block rate. And by the Nylon Calculus rim protection numbers, which haven't been updated in the last few weeks or so, but before then, he actually has been pretty high. Opponents are only shooting 40.4% against him at the rim. He's contesting 38% of shots at the rim when he's on the floor. And he's actually been pretty positive in protecting the basket. And he also, as he always has been great on the boards. So I still think, you know, he's not that old still. You know, he's like 23, 24, something like that. I think probably 24. Maybe there is something here that a team could make something out of with the way he's protected the basket and has actually been able to finish.
Yeah, he's an intriguing player because you think about he does certain things really well. Like his rebounding is awesome. And if you can get those other kind of defensive ancillary things up, shot selection is better. He's probably never going to shoot jumpers that well. I mean, he can work on it in the gym all he wants and hopefully he gets there, but that seems unlikely. But when you look at the other pieces, if those are legit, that's not a starter, but that's a rotation level guy for sure.
Yeah, power forwards who can protect the rim are not all that common, frankly. And I was reminded in kind of looking, I mean, he's shooting just miserably on everything outside of the rim. He's shooting like 20% on anything that's not in the restricted area. And I was reminded of Nazir Muhammad's blog that he did talking about how when he basically sat on the bench to start in Philadelphia, he felt like he just lost his ability to post up because that was never something that he was asked to do. And by the time he got regular minutes, he felt that those skills had completely atrophied. And you go back to what Robinson was supposed to be coming out of the draft. He would attack off the dribble a lot at Kansas. He actually shot some college threes when he was at Kansas. The thought was he can actually be like an above average skilled guy for a power forward. That obviously never materialized. And he basically is just turned into a total energy guy at this point in his career. It seems like he's almost worse at those things than when he started his career. Now, the counter argument to that is, look, there's a reason that you're not doing these things in the NBA. You can do that in college. It's way harder to do it in the NBA. Your skills have an atrophied. It's just you weren't that good at them to begin with, and you couldn't develop them at an NBA level. And that's probably the more likely thing. But it's interesting to think of how this guy's evolution, who was considered a pretty skilled player coming out of Kansas, now to become basically just a pure run and jump athlete. But I still think even in that mold, he can help teams a little bit.
Sure. I was thinking when you were talking about that, about atrophying, that if he could go to the kind of Hawks University for people like Paul Millsap, and just to see if there's a chance of bringing any of that back, just because it's always hard to. And when you do it against college opponents, whether that be Big 12 or anything else, it's a lot different to do it against NBA players, but just to see if there's something in that part of his game that can still be cultivated.
Yeah, so are we going to say that Justin Holliday and Tim Hardaway Jr. are flunking out of Hawks University?
For now, yeah. Give it time. Give it time.
Well, yeah, Justin Holiday already got traded.
Well, yeah, so Justin Holiday, yeah, he got an incomplete.
All right, last team, Sixers. They obviously will not be making the playoffs. And what is their projected record? 15-67?
I have their current one is 14-68. They got knocked down again.
Yeah, that was I'm looking at the old one, yeah.
Yeah, so they're 8-46 right now, 4-10. I think that might be a little bit low. It's hard to know exactly for sure. I talked on Twitter a little bit ago about when the Sixers would pass the Lakers at some point, and that is feeling like it's a little bit less likely, but I feel like there's still an outside chance.
Oh, they have a better net rating than the Lakers do.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, something that I had in here before, which I was pleased on, was that for the second time in a row, the Sixers had doubled their win total between 50-60. So the 50-60. So they were 2-whatever, then they were 4-whatever, now they're 8-46.
Exponential progress in Philadelphia.
/ doing these farther apart.
I want to talk about a couple of their guys. Okafor always is really one of the more fascinating guys to me as a Chicago guy, is a relatively rare player with his ability to finish around the rim, the great moves that he's has. He's shooting a very nice 65% from in the restricted area, and from 3 to 10 feet, he's at 45%. Outside of 10 feet, he only shoots 35% though, from 10 to 16. I think that those are shots that really he hopefully will just not really be taking, especially as this team gets better. And he's not a guy who has a natural kind of jump shot. He sort of hops up on his toes and shoots those jumpers on the way up, and he can make them on occasion. But if he could just dump those shots that he's shooting at a 35% rate and just let some teammates take some more of those or just get closer to the rim, I think that would really help his efficiency. He is not a very good rebounder, but the Sixers at least don't rebound any worse when he's on the court. You know, it's not like he's some unbelievable box out guy, but you know, they're not at least not getting totally killed when he's out there on the boards. And then Nick Stauskas, you know, I thought that the Kings maybe gave up him and him a little bit too early, to the point where they actually like paid an asset to dump him. But it's pretty clear that he has an 8.6 PER, not shooting a good percentage on three still, does absolutely nothing else. One of the worst defensive wings in the league. So it's really just not working for Stauskas. And I think the fact that they've given so many minutes to him this year has been a big reason about why they've been so bad.
He'll be a guy to watch in terms of his fourth year option. I have a feeling like it might be declined.
Yeah, that's a good point. They'll have until October to do that. Kind of see who else is on the roster at that point. And the Sixers actually also waived Jakar Sampson recently, so they could take in Joel Anthony in that salary dump and pick up that.
So something I wanted to ask you about with Jaleel is, do you think, I think Seth Partnow and a couple other people, I support this as well, have thought about the idea of back to the basket bigs on second units. Do you think that that's I'm not saying that's the only thing Okafor can do, but do you think that kind of focusing his minutes on that long term would be a nice use of his skills?
I think he's better than just that, but absolutely, because he's just so big that a lot of teams don't play a traditional center, you know, for like the Mavs, for instance, right? Like there's a game where he was being guarded by Dwight Powell and just completely abused him. You know, he's got 50 pounds on Dwight Powell. So I do think that at the very least you can force, especially because in the regular season, teams just, you know, kind of just want to stick to their rotation. I think actually a lot of teams would be benefited by kind of trying to match up more in regular season games. But, you know, I think he's a guy who could really take advantage of some second unit bigs. So, yeah, I mean, him, Al Jefferson, Gasol, all those kind of post up bigs who are defensive liabilities, I think that really works pretty well for them. And I think that's something we've talked about. One thing I wanted to ask you, how different would this Sixers team be if they had gotten that top five protected Lakers pick last year, if the Lakers had not fallen into the top five? You know, probably Jerry Colangelo is not involved in the franchise, I think, to start.
Yeah, that's definitely a part of it. Also, looking at how well that draft class turned out, they would have probably gotten somebody who would have been a useful contributor.
If they had Moutier, or they had Justice Winslow, or they had Stanley Johnson on this team,
or even Hazonia. Like, as inconsistent and maddening as he can be, that would at least be something that you're sitting there going, oh, well, look at this. Yeah, I agree with you. They also losing the Heat pick, too. They think about where that would have been.
Yeah, I mean, there's some great guys that went in that range. Miles Turner.
Devin Booker went
in that range. Trey Lyles, Devin Booker. You know, I mean, a lot of that, you know, I still despite the fact the sort of lack of emotional intelligence accompanying Sam Hinkie's strategy, I still think that they have been pretty unlucky in sort of the mathematical approach that Sam Hinkie has taken. They've kind of fallen out towards the lower end of that range, whether it was that Heat pick, whether it's that Lakers pick, you know, the 2016 draft. I hate judging drafts in advance, but it would be almost impossible for the 2016 draft to look as good as the 2015 draft has looked throughout, through whatever it is, 60 games or so. So, it really has not worked out for Sam Hinkie. I mean, Joel Embiid was a risk, certainly, but, you know, you fell at like the absolute worst possible, outcome for that risk. So I still think that he got a little bit of a raw deal, and if just pure mathematical numbers had broken a little bit differently for him, you could be talking about how the Sixers have this great young core and, wow, it was only 2 years of pain to put this together and they're really on the upswing this year instead of, you know, hey, you're not even the chief decision maker anymore.
And also the fact that they have all these young assets and have just a boatload of cap space. So you think about that, if they looked better, that you'd be sitting there as certain free agents, maybe not in 2016, but in 2017 going, well, why not join them? Look at all these cheap guys. I can, you know, get a max contract with them and I can be the leader of this awesome young team.
All right, that'll do it for today. You got anything to plug before we go?
I did a podcast with Seth Partnow on the deadline. I wrote a Warriors World piece on kind of ranking the schedule. It's funny because the game I had as the third hardest game was the Clippers game, which they won, and I think 14th was the Blazers game, which they lost. That was kind of my feeling on the tail end of back to backs. And then I'll have Warriors Weekly and League Pass Alert and a couple other new pieces for the Sporting News this coming week.
And I will be recording more Dunked On Basketball podcasts.
Hopefully I'll be doing that too.
We did do a fun trade deadline wrap up, really got into the future cap implications, the future on-court implications of all those trades. If you haven't listened to that, definitely go back and give that a listen. I think it's the most comprehensive trade deadline wrap up that's out there in terms of sort of the overall team building strategy aspects or any other aspects you want to point to. Also follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA and Danny is Danny LaRue, and an iTunes review or rating always really appreciated to help us keep this little endeavor going, get some more sponsors, and keep coming to you for perpetuity, we hope. Talk to you later.